These are the people at the heart of racing. Their lives, their stories, in their own words.
There is a foal as big as a giraffe standing up in the back of the ute. He's doing 85 kilometres an hour.
It just shows that you don't have to be Sheikh Mohammed to win a big race.
The first time I've heard it since I caught it.
Really?
It was so nerve-wracking, Michael.
Of all the things I've done in my career, it would be amongst the most nerve-wracking.
It's probably when I was a paperboy.
What damage can it possibly do to go to the slipper? So we went to the slipper and we won that.
You know, they came in with an iron fist and put all these rules in place, but I don't think any bastard understands it.
For the next hour, RSN 927's Racing Pulse presents Racing's Open Mic.
And it's a great pleasure to have in the studio for today's Racing's Open Mic syndicator Wiley Dalziel. Wiley, great to see you.
Yeah, thanks, Michael. Thanks for having me in. It's very, very good to have in. Thanks.
Well, you've got a diverse background, which we'll go through in a moment, but being a syndicator, I would imagine the last couple of weeks have been extremely busy for you.
Yeah, the last probably 3 months since the Magic Million sale starts, you're on the road and you're heading to all the sales. You're trying to find the value horses and the good horses that you want. So, yeah, it's very busy. Just got back from a week in Sydney yesterday. Peter Moody and myself trying to source a value horse, and couldn't find one up there. And what was a really hot sale. It was quite amazing watching what was going on up there.
Well, you would have found plenty of valuable horses because the price and the money was just astronomical.
It was. Unbelievable. Peter Moon and myself sort of tipped that it was going to be a hot sale. Yeah. When we arrived, they said there was more registered buyers than there were horses. So that was an indicator. There was 404 horses went through. There was 48 withdrawals and William Inglis took on less horses. And, you know, some of the people that were after those blue bloods hadn't got their quota of horses and it was hot. And it can get quite boring at a sale if you're not buying horses for, you know, 4 or 5 days. But it was quite... I quite enjoyed sitting there watching these horses just going through $3, $4, $5 million horses. It was quite unbelievable. So there's a lot of expensive horse flesh out there, and hopefully some of them will do well.
We know Easter is the creme de la creme, but is it getting too difficult for the local buyers with the internationals, the sheikhs all coming in and just spending huge money?
It definitely is, and you need to do your homework. I mean, I've had a big asset in Peter Moody staying on board with me. Even though he finished up training, we got together and I said I wanted Moods on board. And he's been to all the sales. He can get there sort of a few days prior to me. He's gone to all the farms and we've virtually looked at every single horse so he can get the shortlist down for me to then go along with him and make our selection. So I think if you look at enough horses and you stick to your rules and regs, you'll get your horses. But if you don't do all that, you can struggle to find that, you know, horse that's you think's good value.
Well, we'll go through your career as to how you got to where you are now and how many horses you've currently got. But where did it all begin for you? Where did you get your love of racing?
Back when I was about 12, actually, I loved footy, loved all my sport, but I just started picking up form guides at about 12. Used to do a lot of race calls at school, got a few detentions for sort of rattling off the odd race call for the mates when the teachers sort of got a bit louder and the teacher would turn around and send me off to the principal. But yeah, I haven't got a racing family background apart from my grandfather, who was a prisoner of war in the Changi War Camp. And before he went to the war, he was the assistant editor of the Truth newspaper.
Right.
And when he got back from the war, after he was a prisoner of war and he got back and he was an SP bookmaker and he loved his racing. So that's probably the only connection, but he passed away when I was only about 8 or 9. And from there, my dad had a bit of a bet. He didn't mind a bet. And we lived in a little place called Snake Valley, which was 30 Ks out of Ballarat. And I used to just get the form guide, do the form. All my school projects were around, you know, horse racing. And yeah, I sort of didn't have the attention span for some stuff. So I used to just read form guides and play the sport and then sort of dropped out of first term in year 12 and became a chef. But it was just something I picked up, and I don't know, you just like it and sort of once it's in your blood, it's there, I think.
Yeah, it's amazing how some people who have no family background that they can just gravitate to it and pick it up and a great love. And you mentioned your grandfather had a little bit of SP bookmaking in him, and I believe you tried the same at school, did you?
Yeah, I did. I ran a book in year 11. I think these days you'd be arrested and put in jail. But I did the Deb twice, actually. The first time I did it, I think you do it in year 10, and then year 11, and then the next time a girl asked me to do the Deb again, I said, look, I did it last year, and I was a year older. And I said no.
This is the debutante ball.
Yeah, the Deb at high school. And then her name was Melanie Graham. And I said, oh, your dad's a bookmaker, isn't he? And she said, yeah. And I said, oh, well, I'll do the deb with you then. I really want a job with him. So did the deb, and, yeah, I got a job with Noel Graham, and he said, are you good at maths? And I was pretty, as I said, a little bit lazy at school. Used to bluff my way through. I said, oh, yeah, no, I'm a gun at maths, no problems at all. So anyway, so he put me on, and, yeah, we did some country race meetings. We did Flemington the year, Better Loosen Up one. And yeah, that was quite a good experience. And
so were you the scribbler in the old terms?
I was the penciler, so that's why I figured, well, if I don't need to worry about the maths, I've just got to count the money really quick, and that's what I had to do. And I remember one day at Ballarat, Noel said, oh, just grab the pencil and I'll just got to go for a walk. I'll be back in a minute. And I really started, you know, thinking, oh, God, this is no good if someone comes and takes a bet off me. The first bet was very simple. It was 8 to 1, $2, yep, easy. Then someone had $300 at about 6 to 4, and I'm sitting there trying to work it all out. And I've sort of scribbled it, gone away. Anyway, the horse won. The punter came back, gave Noel the ticket. He's looking at it a lot longer than normal, and I'm thinking, oh, I'll just bugger this ride up. And anyway, so he paid him out, said, pay him out. He said, oh, you're about $8 out on that ticket. And I said, oh, sorry. Had a bit of a brain snap, but he worked it out, yeah. So, yeah, just sort of had a bit of a passion for it there. So
a lot of younger punters nowadays wouldn't even know what a scribbler is, but I remember when I was young and you had the bagmen and the scribblers on the old cardboard tickets, you couldn't read what they'd written. Was there a special language?
Yeah, no, I don't know either. It was just scribble that they understood, but they did have the pencil there that was penciling it in, so they must have had some sort of code. But yeah, when I ran the book in year 11, I was quite professional about it. I had my book, I opened it up, you know, 2 months prior. I actually made my own tickets with my initials back the front.
Did you?
Yeah, kept it all professional. Got the student bets from most of the year 11, 12s that wanted to have a bet. I then convinced the PE teacher to get bets off the teachers. And I'm saying, like, you'd normally be these days, you used to make front page news, I reckon. So he got all the teacher bets. I then did my book, Sunshine Sally, was about 300 to 1, or 500 to 1, into about 50 to 1. So I thought, if she wins, I don't know how I'm going to explain this to the parents because I can't pay it out. I then got the teacher to go over to the pub over the road and lay off on the ones I thought, which was Let's Elope.
So 91 Melbourne Cup.
Yep, 1991. Let's Elope won. Shiva's Revenge ran second. The other one's going to cost me, so he laid off on it. And I actually made about $600, so I was quite happy. The students threw some of the tickets on the ground, so, of course, one of the teachers picked it up and sort of worked out. It looked very much like a bookmaker ticket. Fortunately, I was good friends with the vice principal's son. The principal's away. He came over to class, called me in, put me in his office, sat me down, threw the ticket in front of me and said, what's this, Wiley? I said, oh, looks like a bit of paper, Mr. Kerry. And he said, don't be smart. I know you ran a book, didn't you? I said, yeah, I could have, yeah. I said, oh, yeah, sorry, I did. Anyway, I thought, oh, this will be, you know, expelled. Police will be called. Parents will be called for sure. And anyway, he said, well, you're lucky Mr. Robinson's not here. You'd be in heaps of trouble. You'd be all that expelled. I'd call the police. He said, but I'm going to let you off with a warning and just don't do it again. I said, well, I've only got one more year to go, so, you know, hopefully I won't. Then I went to walk off and he stopped. He said, oh, hang on a minute. And I thought, this will be the punishment for sure. And he said, how'd you go? And I said, I won 600. He said, righto, off you go. So, yeah, so that was just some interesting things you do when you're at school, but...
That's great grounding for your life in racing. I thought he was going to ask for a cut because that would have been the real grounding for racing.
So did I, because he used to do the, when you arrived at school, he'd do the schoolyard rounds, and he was a smoker. And he used to, you know, find the smokers, confiscate their cigarettes, and then he'd get you to go away, see you later. But then you'd watch him, he'd walk around behind the tree and light up. So, yeah, I actually thought he might, but he didn't. So, yeah.
Now, I believe in those young school days that you actually spent a bit of time with Robert Smurden. You worked with Smurdy at Ballarat too, is that right?
I did, yeah. Work experience came up, and the teachers say, what do you want to do? And I went to my parents. I said, oh, well, I'd like the horse racing, so I'll give that a bit of a go. So the schoolmaster contacted Robert Smurden. He said, not a problem. The foreman lived around the corner from where I lived. So I actually rocked in there first day, dressed up like the man from Snowy River. I had my moleskins, I had my dryzer bone, I had my big hat. Walked in looking like a dick, and they've all got sneakers and, you know, T-shirts and everything like that looking at me. And just threw me a rake and said, there you go, mate, start shoveling that shit over there and away you go. And that was sort of the way we go. So the next day I ripped all that off and thought, I'll just walk in with jeans. But, yeah, that was a good experience. I did all the grounding there and got to strap a horse. They had Ballarat races on, so they allowed me to take a horse across, and it ran second. So, yeah, that was a good bit of a good buzz. I wanted to be a jockey. And I did speak to Robert about it, and he said, "Oh, how old are you?" And rah, rah, rah. And he said, "Well, you got Buckley's because you're going to be too tall, you're going to be too heavy." And he said, "I'll tell you what, though, if you really do want to be a jockey, you could be a jumps jockey's your only hope." And he said, "I want you to go and meet a guy tomorrow morning called Butch Londrigan."
Mm.
And he rocked in and had half his teeth missing and, you know, it looked like he'd been, you know, bashed against the wall 88 times. And he said, "Oh, you want to be a jumps jockey, do you, mate?" I said, "Oh, I just want to be a jockey, you know, I love the racing industry." And he said, "All right, well, I'll tell you what, you see that brick wall over there?" And I said, "Yeah, I do." He said, "Well, just run at it as hard as you can. Close your eyes, don't stop, just bang straight into it." And he said, "We'll probably have to peer you up off the ground and take you to the Ballarat Hospital. And if you pull through that all right, then have a crack. If not, don't do it." And I said, "Right, I think I'll give it a miss." So that was the end of the jockey dreams.
Gee whiz, it could be a new course in the apprentice school. Yeah. Speaking of Smurdy, what was he like to work for? And did you throw your leg over one? Did you learn how to ride?
No. Horses bluffed me. I had a motorbike when we lived on 10 acres. I got a motorbike. Dad said, "These are the rules. Don't take it on the road. Don't take it to school." And when you're a young kid, you know, you want to do all that. Mum was a nurse. She worked in Ballarat. Dad was a motor mechanic, worked at Beaufort about 50 k's away. So I worked out what time they got home. I'm going to be right. I took my motorbike to school, did the donuts, all that, impressed my mates. And for whatever it is, must be parents' intuition. But he rocked home early, top of the driveway, burning up on my RM80 and in his overalls like this. And I got off it thinking, oh, he didn't see me. And got to the top and he said, "Put it in the shed. It's finished. It's gone." He didn't really give me many second chances. So, cut a long story short, we sold that and didn't have it. And then Mum said, "Well, you got to give him something to do. He's getting bored." So I got a horse from a friend down the road. His daughter had gone to uni, wasn't being ridden. I'd been on trail rides, and they're easy. They're just push-button horses, so I thought, it can't be too hard. This was a retired a quarter horse that hadn't been ridden for a year. It was an ex-barrel horse. So when I got on it, it threw me off. I tried to stop it. It walked backwards, and Dad got on it, couldn't control her either. We rang the local lady that used to break horses in, and she came up and rode it and said, "No, it's not a beginner's horse. It's an ex-cutting barrel horse, not really for Wiley." So we went and got another one, which was a nice quiet horse. He was called Thunder, and I tried to take him as a part Arab thoroughbred. He took off because he'd never had a companion before. Every time I tried to ride him, he just wouldn't go. So he threw me off about three times, and that was it.
That was it.
Nah, forget about that. So, no, I didn't sit on horses, and that's for the... for the jockeys, the strappers, the track riders, and yeah, I take my hat off to them. You've got to be strong with a horse.
Well, before you found your way into syndication, along your road, and you still had your love of racing, you became a chef. There's not too many people involved in racing who can say they're actually a qualified chef. I know there's a lot of trainers out there that clearly like their food,
yeah.
But there's not too many who are trained in the art of making it.
Yeah, well, how that came about is that Dad recognised I wasn't really an academic at school. He said, "I want you to go and get a trade. Oh, I don't care what you do with your life, as long as you get a trade." He was a motor mechanic, Mum was a nurse. Said, "So you're not going to go through uni and become a doctor or a lawyer or anything." So basically, I liked drama at school. I did a lot of acting, quite enjoyed it. And we rang a friend of ours who was an extra on a lot of shows like Blue Heelers and Country Practice. And I spoke to him about it. I said, "Look, I want to be an actor. You know, where do I start?" And he said, "Well, you got to get a job." I said, "Yeah, I'm going to be an actor." He said, "No, you got to get a job to support it because it's too hard. And then you can go to, you know," he mentioned a couple of acting schools, one in South Yarra, and go down that path. So he goes, "What do you like doing?" I said, "Well, I don't mind cooking. Quite enjoy it, you know." And he said, "All right, perfect. You can become a chef. You can go into your acting school. Then you'll hopefully get, you know, a gig and commercials or whatever. And then you can sort of jump and change." So that's how that came about. So then...
how did your acting go? Did you get any jobs?
No, I actually I started acting school, and then again just the discipline kicked in, and I went to three or four, and I actually got a girlfriend back in Ballarat, so I stopped going, and that was the end of that. I got a couple of rehearsals or auditions.
So there's no old Wiley Dalziel commercials out there.
No, there's not. I did a couple of musicals. I played Harry the Horse in Guys and Dolls. Quite
good.
Appropriate. Yeah, that was a bit of fun. But yeah, no, I did enjoy the drama. But again, you've got to be really committed to whatever you do, and acting is definitely full time commitment. So I spoke to the parents. They said no problems. Yep, sounds like a good idea. So I did first term of Year 12, and then I got an apprenticeship in Ballarat for a guy that ran a cafe and also ran a motel at night time. So I I started out there in Ballarat.
Well, you ended up working for Raw Melbourne as their number one chef there. While the President's Cup was on, while Australian Opens were on, you cooked for Tiger and all the top golfers. What were there any special requests?
Yeah, no, it was a real buzz. We I got to cook for the 20 Americans and the 20 internationals and the caddies. And so when they came off the course, we did set up a buffet for them. But if they wanted, you know, anything, we'd get them. And not really. Most of them just wanted fresh. You know, if they wanted a minute steak sandwich or a fresh fruit platter, you just make it up fresh, which was good because I used to take it to them rather, you know, the waiters would come in and say, oh, and I said, just I'll take this one in. So, yeah, it was a really good experience doing all those tournaments. And Royal Melbourne was a great experience too because they sort of really drill the discipline into you. You had to go out and carve in front of the members and put your chef's hat on and, you know, pristine, clean uniform and yes sir, no sir. And it was a great grounding there to work there.
And you parlayed that and your racing interest into what became Chefs on the Run, and you teamed up with Robbie Griffiths, and, and that's where basically it all started in this area of your life.
Yeah, so I didn't own Chefs on the Run. I worked for them. I had an opportunity to be a head chef or get out of the chefing, and a friend of mine who was in chefing said, get out, you know, it's a little bit unrewarding, a little bit underpaying. If you don't have the passion for it, you know, so that was where it was starting to go. My racing passion was definitely what I wanted to do. So I answered an ad to Chefs on the Run. They needed an operations coordinator to put our chefs out into pubs and clubs, and then they had their own catering division. So I went to them. And then I was only there for probably about 6 months and then said I was going to leave. And they sort of said, well, why? And I said, well, I've been offered to buy Melbourne Jockey Management off a gentleman called Steve Walsh. And he managed Patrick Payne, Shane Tronerud, Rodney Griffiths. He had some really good jocks, Stephen King, that were flying. And I'd met him, and he offered me to buy their business or buy his business. And I thought, oh, that'd be good. And anyway, he Chefs on the Run sort of pulled me in and said, look, you know, if you take this on, because I said, look, if you guys do it with me, that'd be better. And they said, if all your jockeys leave and they don't like you, well, you've got no business left. So, and I probably didn't have the business, you know, now to probably do it either. So they kept me there and they said, well, what's your idea? And I said, well, to me, there's communication lacking in the racing industry. It's not necessarily the trainer's fault. They're working long hours and you know, good social activities. And that's really what needs to happen. So they said, well, we'll have a go at it. You know, the deal was that we need to promote Chefs on the Run to the industry and try and get catering business back and work back. So we went and leased a horse called the Galloping Chef to try and help, and it went and won its first start. So that's really the foray that led me to the racing and into with Chefs on the Run.
Wally Dalziel's our special in studio guest and racing's open mic. We're going to take a break on the next phase. We're going to talk about the next chapter of your life and how it really changed, and that's when you met the great late Roy Higgins. Welcome back to Racing Pulse's open mic. Wiley Dalziel, syndicator, is our special in-studio guest. We've been through your early doors career, Wiley, where you got your interest and your love of racing, and you were a trained chef that then parlayed into Chefs on the Run, and then in 2001, you met Roy Higgins, and he became a very big part of your life.
Yeah, no, Roy was massive. So how I met Roy is we did a punning chef competition for the listeners of 927, it would have been back then, and where we'd a caller would ring up, answer a question, and I'd meet them at the races in my chef's uniform, give them their $200, and Roy did the mounting yard reports then, so he'd see me standing there in my chef's uniform. He obviously was a part of 927 doing the mounting yard reports, and he said to me, oh, you're that Chef's on the Run, aren't you? I said, yeah, I'm the chef and the punning chef. And he said, oh, well, good on you, you know, for having a go. This is after about the third or fourth week of seeing me. He said, well, good on you, you're young, you're having a go, and you're enthusiastic, and if I can do anything to help, let me know. So I sort of thought, well, that's pretty good, getting Roy Higgins to offer a hand. So I followed him up on it. I gave him a call, and I went round to his house in Brighton. I told him that what my idea was with Chefs on the Run was to, you know, promote good communication, good social activities, and try and buy some horses and, you know, Chefs on the Run put on stable functions and give people a good time. And he said no initially. He said, I've been there, done all that, it's too hard. He had Hyperion Syndication, which I believe didn't end too well. And so he said no. So I thought, oh, okay, fair enough. So a couple of weeks later, I thought, I'll have another crack at him, and said, oh, can I come and see you again, Roy? And I took a couple of bottles of red around this time because he loved red wine, so I thought that'll help. And so I sat down with him. I said, Roy, this is not about, I'm going to keep working full time, and this is to try and promote Chefs on the Run, and they'll get behind it. You're going to keep working full time. This is going to be built slowly. We'll just get a share in each horse that we buy. And it's not about burning anyone. It's really about looking after people. It's not about making any money. So he had a bit more of a think about it. He said, all right, well, I'll, and then the directors of Chefs on the Run met him as well and had a chat with him and said, you know, if it worries you, we'll give you the checkbook. You know, you can write all the checks and all that sort of stuff. And so he agreed to it. And, you know, away we started. And, we teamed up with Robbie Griffiths at the time. I actually worked with Robbie's mum when I was chefing. And,
oh, really?
Met. She worked at the Edmund Barton Centre in Moorabbin. And that's when I met Rodney Griffiths. And then, yeah, that's when we sort of met Robbie and decided that's where we'll go and build it up from there. So the first two horses we bought were Ra Sun. He ran second at Moonee Valley, beaten a nose, should have won. He then won the Group 2 Maribyrnong Plate. And we bought a horse called Arena Star, who ran won on debut at Bendigo and then ran second in the listed race. So it all happened in a fair start, a really good start, and a good start for me in the way that Roy said, you know, this doesn't always happen like this. And he wanted me to learn about the whole ownership, you know, managing owners, because he said that's going to be your hardest part, managing expectations. And so he that horse basically was, we were offered $1 million for that horse. It was 750 initially. Roy being the wise man, knowing, said, you know, tell them to take it. It's a very good offer. I asked all the owners, Wiley, you sold this.
How much did the horse cost?
He cost $125,000.
And they were offered $750.
Yeah, and offered $750, which is quite a lot of money for a General Nadim at the time. He was the first season sire for one of the sons of General Nadim. And so Roy said, tell them to take it. You know, that's, you don't get those offers. And anyway, they all knocked it back. Said, well, you sold this as fun, having a good time, not in it for the money and all that sort of stuff. And so I rang Roy back, said, no one took it. So he said, all right. We rang the agent back, and the agent had a bit more in the coffers. He said, $1 million.
Jeez.
So I got back on the phone to everyone, and no one wanted to take it. So cut a long story short, the horse never won a race again.
And
he never won a race again. And it's quite frustrating, because when they start at that level, owners, they just find it a bit hard. Well, why isn't it winning now at this level?
Yeah, you know, unrealistic expectations.
Yeah, it's hard, and then that's, you know, horse racing. But I quickly learnt, you know, and then it got to a stage where they said, take it off the trainer and give it to Smurden or give it to Moody or sell it, and it gets, you know, you're like a ping pong ball. We're always sitting there sort of laughing through the whole process, but he wanted me to learn. So anyway, in the end, we agreed to sell it. All the owners said, no, sell it. And I think an agent bought it, and ended up with Peter Moody. And anyway, it went on to win another $300,000 after we sold it.
What did you sell it for then?
About
$17,000. So from $1 million to $17,000,
Yeah, $17,000.
And that's a nice introduction to racing.
It was. It was a good learning curve. And look, he ended up winning. And Peter Moody had General Nadim with Mitchell, Bill Mitchell, and he just swam the horse, kept him fresh, and trialled him up. And yeah, sometimes when you have a trainer change, it works, and that's what it did for them. So good on them. But it was a good learning curve, yeah.
So for you, when you go to, what background knowledge did you have of buying horses, pedigree, type? And was Roy teaching you that, was he?
Definitely. I had zero knowledge. I tend to be a person that just sits back and listens and watches. I don't sort of think I know everything and walk in. And so I just walked in with Roy to the Melbourne Premier Yearling Sales, just walked around, didn't say anything. Roy introduced me to people, and he'd literally just pull one horse out after another horse. And some horses he'd look at for a minute, put it away. Others he'd look at for 3 or 4 minutes. So, you know, and he used to just tell me what he was looking for. You know, some trainers have different likes and different dislikes. So it's really just a case of was going around with Roy, and it's not just about the horse, it's also the knowledge that he had about the industry, you know. So that was invaluable to get all that knowledge, and Roy was probably the best person I could have met, because he was just such a champion in every way. He was such a good people person. He included, you know, everyone, no matter what stature you were, no matter how much money, whether what you did. He was a person that could walk into a room, just light it up, and include everyone from the executive through to the cleaner. You just include everyone.
Wiley Dalziel's our special guest on Racing's Open. Mike, when you start up a syndication business like you did, and you were lucky, you started with a couple of really nice ones, but how tough is it to get it off the ground and to get that bank? Or are you basically putting your own financial health on the line and buying on credit?
Yeah, most trainers will tell you that's what we're doing. we've built it up since 2002. It's changed shape a little bit. I left, obviously left Chefs on the Run and went to ISBet, Sportsbet, and changed the shape of it a little bit and the name of it and things. But there's a lot of work that goes into it. And I remember Roy said to me, it'll take time. There's a lot of fly-by-nighters in racing that come in and go bang, and then you see them exit the game in a year or two or 3 years. So it's really just been a slow progression, and you can't really rely on that top horse to get to you the next level. They definitely help you. They help your profile. To me, it's always been about consistency and strike rate. So, you know, I want to get those good horses, and I'm sure we will, but I believe if you can get consistency, if you can go and buy 20 horses and, you know, get 15 or 16 of them to win, it's a really high strike rate, which we've managed to do with, it's a better return for the owners, and you'll find that they'll reinvest. But then you get a lot of loyal clients and people that you just build up along the way that'll say, well, I'm in again, but I just want to see what you buy.
Mm.
So it's very hard to just sort of, you know, go and buy the horse for somebody. We do now get a few orders, which is really good. Someone will say, well, I want a filly, or I want a Sebring. Away you go. But you're very much specking, and you're very much buying the horse and hoping that you've got enough following and enough people that are going to ring you up and say, Wiley, I want to share in that horse.
Well, you wouldn't be where you are today if it wasn't for Roy, and he obviously became a very close friend of yours, and sadly he got sick and he passed away. But before he did, Bring Me the Maid must be a special horse for you.
She was. She was special in many ways. They actually nicknamed her Gift at the stables, which was quite bizarre. When Roy was sick, we found this out, you know, nicknames Gift, and that's what she was. Roy didn't like flying, and we used to only go to Melbourne Premier, and we'd only buy four or five horses, so it probably didn't matter so much. But I said to Roy, we need to go to all the sales, really. Like, if we're going to find horses come from everywhere. And he said, well, I don't like flying, so you're on your own into the degree where you're going to be looking at them. But he had enough confidence in me to go up and look at them, so he catalogued them. We teamed up with Peter Moody at that stage, and obviously, so he was confident Moods was there as well. So we went up, we had a look around. I actually had an order for a Northern Meteor from a good friend of mine, a good client now, Brett Carr, and he'd lost a 10-month-old Northern Meteor, and he said, if you can find me a nice filly, I'll take, you know, a good 30 or 40, 50% of it. So I like to talk to the trainers. I spoke to Moods and a couple of the other trainers and said, what do you think, Sebring or Northern Meteor? And both of them said, I think Northern Meteor will make it, and not condemning in, but I'd go a Sebring before I'd go a Northern Meteor. So we'd penciled in Bring Me the Maid, who was Sebring Maid for me. I went and had a look at her myself. I liked her, and then I went and spoke to Peter Moody, and he said, yeah, real two-year-old type, nice horse. Probably won't get it. Mm. It's probably going to be too expensive, but we'll just be there anyway. So we got it for $115,000, and she went on to really arrive at the right time, because Roy got sick. That was 12 months later, but when she sort of started to deliver on the track, he was getting, you know, he got quite sick. We were always quite concerned. It was a tough period. And I was spending a lot of time in the hospital with him, as well as trying to go out to the sales, but my main focus was Roy. And it brought a lot of light to his face in the hospital. You know, a good friend of his, Sue Sarkis, who was with him, would ring me and say that, you know, I gave him a catalogue. We took a laptop in for him, so he watched the sales, and it really pepped him right up when he was in the hospital. So she was a really special horse to come along and do what she did. And when she won that listed race at Flemington, I said to the owners, you've got to excuse me, I'm going to take the trophy in and sit with Roy for the afternoon, which they totally understood. So we went in there and took the trophy and watched the rest of the races, and he was having a great day. And then, unfortunately, the 7 days later, we lost him.
Mm. Yeah, it's such a sad time, but an icon of racing. You must feel blessed that you got to get so close to him.
Yeah, absolutely. He shared some amazing stories with me. Some I could repeat, some I couldn't. he was good like that. He'd sort of tell me in confidence, but he just knew everything. It was amazing that you'd ring him up and say, oh, I heard this, and you'd go, oh, yeah, what'd you hear? And he'd know. He'd know the answers before everything happened. And as I said, he just had so much knowledge for he was a jockey, you know, he was a people person, he was in industry, just had the knack and a good bloke to deal with, you know.
Well, she went on to be an outstanding filly, finishing third in the Golden Slipper. Let's have a listen to the closing stages, and I want you to tell me about Slipper Day.
into the straight now, and the loping is in front with Earthquake moving up on the outside. Oakley Girl, Moss Fun down on the rail, and further back Jabali and then Ghibellines, but Earthquake in the centre of the track, and Moss Fun have hit the lead together, and then came a loping, but it's Earthquake out in the middle. She's taken the lead clearly. Moss Fun is next and down the outside. Memorial's running on. Moss Fun's kicking back on the inside. Earthquake's dying in a run, and Moss Fun! Moss Fun right along the rail has won it from Earthquake. Photo for third, Bring Me the Mate and Believe Yourself, followed by Memorial and Oakley Girl.
It's a pretty good golden slipper. Earthquake was the superstar, and Moss Fun, who nutted her on the line. You finished third in a golden slipper. That day must have been like a dream for you.
It was, and it was just surreal, really, and what was a massive sort of lead-up, because, as I say, there was a lot of things I was doing with Roy. I assisted the daughters with the funeral, which was quite draining. So I was pretty mentally exhausted by the time I got to the slipper, and to run third, like, we were all so excited, you know, like you would have thought we'd have won, but a third in a golden slipper is, you know, a massive achievement. Mm-hmm. And it was just a huge thrill, and to run third in a slipper, it just doesn't happen every day of the week. So we're all very grateful, and it was a super day. I was pretty mentally drained by the end of it all, but it was a great experience.
Wally Dalziel is our special in-studio guest on Racing's Open Mic. We're going to take a break. On the other side, we're going to talk about some of the other good horses that you've got, including Harlow Gold and her campaign and her stellar run on the weekend, and also how you got to acquire Black Caviar's little brother. Syndicator Wiley Dalziel is our special in-studio guest. Wiley, I want to talk about the horses you've got currently, but before we get there, I've got to ask you about Moshe. Mm-hmm. You bought Black Caviar's little brother before we even knew about Black Caviar.
Yeah, probably a bit lucky there in terms of she hadn't raced before we bought him. We went to the Melbourne Premier Yearling Sales, and the global financial crisis had sort of hit in when we bought him. William Inglis were a little bit worried. They spoke to all the vendors and told them to halve a lot of their reserves. I wasn't actually there when we bought him. Roy was there. John Hawkes spotted the horse, liked him, spoke to Roy, said, "We've got a nice horse here." Roy had a look at it, he agreed, he liked it, and he thought, "Oh, you won't get him, it'll be too expensive." And anyway, Roy rang me and said, "We've bought this Ballasprey Helsingi colt for $75,000. Mm. And I said, "Oh, that sounds right." He said, "Oh, he's a really nice type, and thought we'd have to pay a lot more." And so that's good. So we had a few people that wanted to get involved in him, so we filled him up relatively quickly with a few sort of long standing clients. And probably about 2 months later, there was an article in the paper that a horse called Black Caviar had won a trial at Cranbourne by 6 lengths. I was working at Mark Reed's IAS bet then, and a gentleman called Albert Cavallo, who I was taking over from, who actually works with me now in the racing, said, "Oh, didn't you buy a Ballasprey Helsingi?" I said, "We did." He said, "Oh, the sister just won a trial and looks really smart." So I sent it out to the owners, and I said, "Keep an eye on this horse, and Black Caviar, she looks pretty good." So we watched her win her first race at Flemington, and it was obviously quite amazing. And then 6 starts later, she's still undefeated, and my job from there was to try and keep the owners, our owners, on feet on the ground, because as they sort of now understand, it's not always the sister's superstar, the brother's going to be a superstar. So John and Wayne Hawkes had said that the horse goes pretty good. You know, he's a nice horse, and hopefully he should be city class. We he debuted at Bendigo. Mm. He was $1.75. I clearly remember sending an email to all the owners the night before without dampening their enthusiasm. I said, "The worst thing you can do is go to the races tomorrow
expecting
Black Caviar or, you know, some freak to win by 6 or 7 lengths. So just go there, enjoy the occasion, you know, and go from there." Anyway, he won by 6 lengths, eased up on the line, and probably potentially could have broken the track record if Dunny had sort of let him off the leash a little bit more. But it was a great win, and he gave me the longest interview in Australia. I reckon they actually ditched the Hawkesbury Mounting Yard to do a 6 or 7 interview mm. about it all. So, you know, just it was a fun ride, but it was a roller coaster ride, you know. So, you know, he unfortunately got injured. He had great potential. I don't think he was a Group 1 horse. John Hawkes felt maybe a listed Group 3 winner. But then, yeah, unfortunately got injured. Luckily, we hadn't gelded him, and we were able to strike a deal with Eliza Park and send him to stud, and he's finished leading first season sire off the back of a lot of mares, but probably not great mares. So it was a great a ride for the owners, and it still is because they're all involved in him and they've got a breeding right and all that sort of stuff. But he certainly helped, and it was a great experience and good to have, you know, some connection there with Black Caviar.
Yeah, they're the racing stories here, just through sheer luck sometimes.
Yep.
It's the way the coin falls, doesn't it? Talk about Harlow Gold, who's the star of the business at the moment. Gee, she's a good filly. She has been so tough in both the spring and the autumn. What do you make of her run in the Oaks? I know she got beaten a long way, but it's been a big campaign.
Yeah, it has been a big campaign, and she's still very babyish. Like, she's, we think she's going to be a really good 4 and 5 year old, and it's good to see the Tavistocks have kicked on as 4 year olds, and there's a couple from New Zealand heading over that they believe are Group One horses. So she's just so consistent, and that's what I like in horses. Honesty and consistency in a horse, you know, far outweighs a horse to me that just wins one all of a sudden, and then, you know, and then he's average or can't perform, or she perform after that. So, you know, I tell all the owners, I know they're excited, and even when we run fourth, you know, I've said, you've just, okay, it didn't happen today. She did pull up a little bit sore. She probably didn't really appreciate the soft tracks, we don't think. And the winner was just far too good. Mm. You know, it was far too good. We're never going to beat that. And, you know, to run fourth in a Group One Oaks, a serious race, it goes on her resume. And she's got 5 bits of black type on her page in 11 starts. You know, we paid $200,000 for her, which was a, you know, we'll pay a little bit for fillies, because if you can get that black type, even though I sell this as a dream and a hobby and a bit of fun and don't do it for the money, I'm running it in the back of my head like a business. And I believe if you're buying fillies, that's the way to go, because most of the colts are gelded. So if you can get some black type in a filly. So she's worth a lot of money, and she's so honest and she's tough, and I'm sure she's going to win a Group One. It's just a matter of when it happens.
Where does she go now, or is that it for this campaign?
No, she'll be back probably in the next couple of days from Randwick. She was stabled up there for a couple of weeks after the Vinery. David was just going to have a think about it and see whether we pushed on to a race like the South Australian Derby, which is a cup qualifier, or whether she goes out to the paddock. And that'll just, you know, be determined by her. If she copes okay and she's still all right, maybe we go there. Otherwise, she'll go out for a spell and then we'll just bring her back in the spring. And obviously, you know, we're all thinking she's a cups horse in time.
How do you choose your trainers? How many trainers do you have?
So we've got David Hayes and Kieran Maher. Most of my horses were with Peter Moody, who I've obviously got a great relationship with, and Pete's on board with me still in the horses that we're all buying. So when we unfortunately had to move the horses, and obviously not going to relive it, but Pete went through that unfortunate experience with the Cobalt, and he rang me and said, look, sorry, we've got to move these horses, but we'd had plan A and B, so I'm not going to leave you or the owners in the lurch. So we'd sort of, you know, thrown around a few trainers, and I sort of suggested a couple of moods, and he said, yeah, Kieran Maher would be good, and David Hayes is Flemington, and Lindsay Park would be good. So we put it to the owners and said, we believe this is where they should go, and they all voted, and most of them ended up with Kieran and David. And we've got some with Philip Stokes, about 16 with Philip Stokes in Adelaide. He's a great trainer, great person to deal with. We've got some with Brian Guy on the Gold Coast, and we've just bought one with James Cummings. So predominantly we're, and this year we've bought 4 with Darren Weir, but, you know, obviously you find we try and support the younger trainers and the up-and-coming trainers, but it is a bit harder because owners want those trainers that are always in the limelight, always winning the group races. So hence, you know, David Hayes, great results, Kieran Maher, and you want to be able to deal with them really well as well. I don't want to just be a cog in a wheel. I want to be able to deal with them, and David Hayes was really good when I sort of went to him, and yeah, I found him really good to deal with on all levels, and the same with Kieran, and the same with Stokes in all the trainers we use. So we're trying to get just honesty, and if I said to Dave, the horses are no good, just let us know, and we either sell them on or retire them as geldings rather than, you know, 9 or 10 starts and they've run 3rd and 4th. If it's not going to happen in the first 4 or 5 starts, if they're not a staying type, well, you generally should move them on and save the owner's training fee. So they've all been really good like that, and then it's just a matter of educating the owners to say, look, it's better off to not pay these training fees for another 12 months on a horse that might win a maiden.
Mm.
We're better off to sell it off now or retire it.
We've had a couple of syndicators in here, and syndication probably is the way of the future for ownership in Australia, because it is hard with the prices that horses bring. But what are the costs for owners out there? I mean, you've got to make a living, you've got to earn, you've got to provide for your family. So what are the costs for owners out there?
Yeah, well, as I say, it depends what level you're buying them at. I mean, our cheapest horse this year, which we bought with Michelle Payne, actually was a $16,000 filly. Very affordable, very easy to get into once you put all your usual costs, your normal costs on. We have a small margin. And then,
would a margin, a small margin be percentage-wise?
We put a 5% bloodstock margin on it, and then we just put either a $5,000 or $10,000 fee on them. So, and then you do your disclosure statements, and they're all there, and the partnership agreements are all there for people to see. And then, you know, you provide the service, the communication, the updates, and you manage the owners right the way through. So, you know, people can get in for as little as $500, you know, especially if they do a syndicate, which we promote, you know, through to anywhere from $20,000 or $30,000 for a 5 or 10% share. It really depends what level. But we try and make it affordable across the board for everybody because everyone's got a different budget. And it's proven that you don't have to buy expensive horse flesh to win it. I mean, Derby Racing did a fantastic job winning the Golden Slipper. Yeah. With She Will Reign at $20,000. They had Yankee Rose for $10,000. That ran second. So you don't need to spend the big money. Catch a Fire was a $40,000 filly that we bought, won a Group 2, and she's potentially worth, you know, $600,000 plus as a broodmare. So you just cater on all types. But, yeah, the perception of people saying, oh, it's too expensive, it's not. Yeah, it's just a matter of how you do it and how you approach it.
And are there plenty of owners out there?
There are. Yeah, no, definitely if you put it out there. And it's more just talking. We're very much a referral. As we don't do a lot of advertising. In fact, we don't do any advertising. It's more referral, and owners have had a good experience and they come on board and they introduce you to them, and then you just explain it. The first thing I explain is I don't want them to get into it to make money. I'd rather turn people away if that's their expectation and they're grabbing their last pennies out of the bank hoping this horse is going to, you know, get them through. I talk them out of it. So that's the main thing. And once people go, yeah, no, that's fine, I'm in, then you get them on board and then try and spread them over a few horses. That's what I try and do because if you put all your eggs in one basket, you mightn't have the success. But if you can, instead of buying 10%, buy 2 5%, or, you know, go and get five mates that are all committed and get 3 5% shares. And I find that works really well. And people get a taste for it then too, and they understand it. And they might have a bit more money there and they're willing to put it into a filly. And then if they get black type, well, they have actually, you know, funded their hobby.
Well, Wiley, we have a lot of listeners out there. Some of them might want to go into a horse syndication, but they need some money. We need to find a winner.
Right.
What have you got in the stable at the moment, and what are you looking forward to? I know you've got a runner today, Bendigo.
We have. We've got Global Rocket. Nice horse. Just taking a little bit more time. He actually knocked himself in a trial when he was ready to go to Sandown. So we had to not go there. He was then ready to go to Geelong. We had a little hiccup with a barrier certificate we thought he had, which he didn't. So he ran a really good race today.
So he's a first starter from the Hayes Dabernick stable, race 3 at Bendigo.
Yep, he's by Smart Missile. So he's a good each way chance. Catch a Fire, she's sort of been knocking on the door and thereabouts. She'll run on Saturday, and Throstle will run on Saturday. Mm. He's back in class after competing in the Group 1 Guineas. Then went to Pakenham, won easily, and so he'd definitely be a chance. We've got quite a few trialers this morning. Horse called Henpecker. We quite rate her. She was a $40,000 Rip Van Winkle that Peter Moody and I bought from New Zealand. We're thinking she's a Queensland Oaks type filly. Kieran Maher's got her. So she'll kick off. She was going to run Wednesday Ballarat. She's drawn poorly, so we're going to wait till the weekend. Miss Wonderland is a good filly, Group 3 placed. Again, she's nice and valuable now. She went and competed in the Magic Millions, ran 7th of 16. It was a good run. So she's going to be aimed at probably the Brisbane Carnival. Horse trialing this morning called Lunar Missile with Brian Guy. Good relation to Lucky Bubbles, a good horse. He's looks like he's in for a good campaign. So, and Phelps Glory is a horse with that won his first start at Morfettville. And he's hopefully being set for the Adelaide Carnival. So there's a few of those horses. Then you've got some other nice two-year-olds that are sort of trialled, showed potential. Until they race, though, you never put wraps on them because that really the trialling to the racing can be a bit of a difference in them. So, and then, you know, hopefully we'll have some bullets to fire in the spring with Harlow Gold and those sort of horses.
If there was one race you could win or you dreamed to win, what is it?
Geez, all of them. I suppose Melbourne Cups it would be a game changer for anybody. No matter what your stature is or the size of your wallet, the Melbourne Cup, you know, is just an emotional roller coaster. So we've started targeting these New Zealand horses. So hence we went and bought 4 and we've managed to get Harlow Gold there. The Derbies and the Oaks are great races to win, and I believe the only way you're going to win them is with the New Zealand horses, and they've proven it again with you know, the Derby winner and the Oaks winner. So we've bought seven there this year. But yeah, I'd say definitely you'd have to put the Melbourne Cup up there. And you know, Golden Slipper and Blue Diamonds are exciting 2-year-old races to win in the Guineas. So yeah,
can you believe where you are from a young kid that started out running a book, that now you have horses with the leading trainers around Australia?
Yeah, no, like, it's just the old thing, you know. You see sports athletes and people that they win a gold medal and they say it's just all about passion and follow your dreams, and that's very much what I've done. It's been a rocky road and it's been hard work and nothing comes easy, but you've just got to keep going and keep doing the right things, and I'm sure all that will happen. But yeah, I enjoy cooking. I don't think I'll go back to it.
What's your go-to dish?
Oh, I love all food, but Asian food I quite like. I like cooking modern Australian, you know, good steaks and all that sort of stuff. But yeah, no, I enjoy cooking at home for the kids and the wife and kids and when I'm there. And but if I had to go back into a kitchen now and serve, you know, 100 people in an hour, I don't know if I could do it. So hopefully we'll keep this dream going along and getting enough people behind us.
Well, the horses are certainly going well, so you might be able to keep away from the apron for a while. Good luck today with Global Rocket in the third at Bendigo, and thanks for coming in. It's been a fascinating insight into your life, your background, and as to how you've got to where you are today.
Yeah, thanks, Michael. Really appreciate it, and thanks for having me in.
Wally Dalziel, and if you want to get a horse with Wally Dalziel Syndicators, just get on the website, Wally Dalziel Racing. You'll find plenty of good ones there. That brings us to a close on Racing Pulse today. I hope you've enjoyed the show. If you missed the interview with Peter Verlandis, it will be up on the RSN website under Racing Pulse. And tomorrow we'll have a chat to the new chair of Racing Australia. I'll be interested, very interested to get her thoughts on Peter Verlandis' views today as well. Enjoy your day. We'll be back tomorrow from 8:30.